You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 205 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Human Being as Body and Soul in Relation to the Cosmos, 13 lectures, translated by William Forward. This is Lecture 4, given in Dornach on the 26th of June, 1921. The day before yesterday, we spoke of what a Greek from the period when there was still a more inward approach to knowledge would have thought of today's view of the world, the scientific perspective. I then tried to set out how, from the perspective of imaginative knowledge, such a Greek would have described what we tend to refer to as the human etheric body in relation to the element of water. I said, imaginative understanding would see a certain connection between the whole working of water, the waving and weaving of the element of water, its reaching out to the widths, its sinking toward the depths of the earth, and how these forces are connected with the individual manifestations of the life of plants. We are led in this way to a concrete example of what we find in the imaginative world, or at least a part of the imaginative world. It is a form of knowledge we can only attain in practice by going through a process of development, such as I have described in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, with the aim of acquiring imaginative knowledge. Even this form of knowledge, however, would leave us in the dark with respect to what is described as the element of air in the earlier view of the world. As the ancients saw it, this element of air can only be fully understood by a so-called inspired consciousness. You will get an idea of inspired consciousness, this experience of the element of air, if you try to imagine the following. I have often mentioned how today's view of the human being is based quite strongly on outer appearances. We need only remind ourselves of how today's images of human anatomy or physiology are composed. They are made to look as if there are clear contours to the internal organs, heart, liver, and lungs, etc. These clear contours are, of course, to some extent justified. The problem is that in using them we portray our bodies as if they were solid bodies, which they are not, of course. The very least part of our anatomy is composed of solid mineral substance. At the very most, we could reckon with 8% of the human body being solid. 92% of the human body is a column of liquid. It is not solid. The solid elements are merely deposits within us. Little attention is drawn to this among today's students of physiology, anatomy, and so on. We do not develop any understanding of the watery human being, of our fluid nature, if we represent it with clearly contoured organs. We are, on the contrary, in a process of constant flow, and our organism is in a state of constant movement. Our airy organism is integrated into this fluid system. Air streams in, combines with substances within us, and whisks them up, so to speak. It is only by virtue of this airy element within us that we are fully at one with the world outside us. The air that is now inside me was not there a moment ago. It was outside. The air that is now inside me will soon be outside again. Looking at our nature from the perspective of this third element, the element of air, we cannot really say that we are enclosed within our skin, and we are even less so with regard to the element of warmth or fire. It cannot truly be said that we are entirely self-contained. Let us now compare what we see as the complete human being, one who is not just organized as a solid body, but whose organization includes the elements of water, air, and warmth, with someone who is asleep. The warmth is integrated, and in constant intermingling movement, with the same person who is asleep, with both soul and spirit absent from the etheric and physical bodies lying there. The soul and spirit with which we are imbued when we are awake are not there between us falling asleep and waking up. They are in another world, which has its own rules, and we must ask ourselves, quote, what are the rules that apply in the world we inhabit between falling asleep and waking up? Close quote. Yesterday we laid out four different sets of laws. Firstly, the laws governing the earthly world. Secondly, the laws that apply within the world of the cosmos. Thirdly, the laws within the cosmic soul. And fourthly, the laws governing the cosmic spirit. We ask ourselves, quote, where are we with our soul and spirit, or with our soul, life, and I, capital, between falling asleep and waking up? Close quote. Now, on reflection and comparison with what we have said before, it becomes clear that the astral body and the I are here between the time of falling asleep and waking in the region of the cosmic soul and of the cosmic spirit. Number one, the laws that apply within the earthly world. Number two, the laws that apply within the cosmos. Number three and four are the laws that apply to the cosmic soul, the laws that apply to the cosmic spirit, and those are bracketed with the astral body and I. We must treat what was said yesterday very seriously, namely that the two first worlds, the earthly and the cosmic, are all that there is in the realm of space. So when entering these other two realms, we have already left the realm of space. We have to sharpen our awareness of this continually. Every time we sleep, as has often been said, we are led not only beyond our physical bodies, but also beyond the whole realm of normal space. We are led into a world which may not in any way be confused with the world which we can perceive with our senses. This world is governed by all the laws which apply to our rhythmic nature, that imbues our watery element and our airy element with rhythm. This rhythm appears in space, but the source of the rhythm, the principles at work in what produces the rhythm, all spring forth at every point in space from depths that lie beyond space. It is governed by a real world that lies beyond sense perceptible space. When we contemplate the wonderful interaction within us of our breathing rhythm and the beat of our pulse, we can perceive, coming into the world we inhabit as physical human beings, a quality in this rhythm that springs from an order prevailing beyond space, and which is founded in the spirit. We can have no understanding of the airy element until we achieve a concrete grasp of what expresses itself in the rhythmic processes at work in us within this airy element. When we are using our powers of imagination to grasp what I described to you yesterday, the weaving of the world of plants and the parallel weaving of the watery element in our own body, we are still within the world we normally inhabit. What we have to do is to think of ourselves as transported away from the earth, poured out, as it were, into the whole cosmos. But if we take the step into the element of air, we have to project ourselves beyond space. We have to be able to recognize that we are in a world which no longer has a spatial dimension, but exists only in time. A world in which only time has a meaning. In the days when people could have a living experience of this, they were able to see the properties of such a world as including the work of the spirit playing into human activity indirectly via rhythm. I drew attention to how the Greek of ancient times formed the hexameter, three beats of our pulse, together with the caesura corresponding to one breath, and a further three heartbeats, with a caesura, or the end of the verse, completing the hexameter, two breaths, and their corresponding eight heartbeats. This harmony of breathing and pulse was artistically integrated into the recitation of Greek hexameter. The way in which we are permeated by our supersensible nature, trickling into our blood circulation, our pulse beat, and synthesizing itself into four rhythmic pulse beats, two, one breath, is replicated in the speech formation of the hexameter. From the very beginning, all efforts to compose verse have been drawn from this rhythmic organization within us. We ourselves can only experience the world from which this rhythmic activity originates when we become conscious in our sleeping state. The activity in which we are asleep but conscious plays into our own rhythm. We are oblivious to what is going on there in our normal everyday consciousness, let alone in the scientific consciousness of today. If we do attain this consciousness, then not only do we become aware of what I described yesterday, the surging, weaving, waving world of the plants, but now also a phenomenon which goes beyond the images common to the animal world, which would, after all, be spatial, a clear consciousness, which can only occur outside our body, not inside it, which contains the concrete pictures from which the forms of the animals as they appear in space are drawn. Just as our human rhythms bubble into us from a realm beyond space, the forms in which the various animals are organized also bubble into them from the world that lies beyond space. The first thing we notice when we consciously experience how we normally are between falling asleep and waking, when we dive into the world which is the source of our rhythm, is that we understand the animal world in all its forms. This cannot be explained on the basis of outer physical forces. If zoologists or morphologists believe they can explain the form of a lion, a tiger, a butterfly, or a beetle on the basis of anything that can be found in physical space, they are deluded. Nothing in our physical world here is capable of explaining the forms of the animal world. We only encounter it in the way I have described when we enter into the third of the guiding principles, the guiding principle of the cosmic soul. Now I'd like once more to go back to the Greek whom we heard in conversation yesterday with a modern educated person who knows everything. Well, this person occasionally admits to not knowing everything, but does, nevertheless, claim that everything must be capable of explanation in his way. The Greek would say, quote, "Nothing at all can be explained in your way, because I have heard that you have something like a form of logic. This involves listing all kinds of abstract concepts in categories, such as to be, to become, and to have, etc. This logic is governed by what are supposed to be the principles of concepts and ideas." Close quote. If I think back to a Greek from the pre-Socratic era, when the philosophies of Thales, Heraclitus, and Anaxagoras were developed, which are now only partially extant, he would say that what we now call logic was made by a person who no longer had much knowledge of the secrets of the world. It was developed by Aristotle after he had applied his Philistine view of the world to Platonism. Aristotle was, of course, a great man, but also a great Philistine who totally corrupted real logic. He converted real logic into a fabric which relates to reality in the same way that something finely woven and insubstantial relates to something solid and real. The Greek from this era, who would have been a scientist in his own way, would say, quote, "Real logic includes the forms which become outwardly visible in the animal world, and to which we can have access only when we become conscious in the state we are in between sleeping and waking. That is what real logic is, the real content of logical consciousness. Close quote. The animal world contains nothing different from what is in the human world, but in the human world it is spiritualized. So we can think the logical forms that project into the outer world and become animals. Just as when we contemplate our etheric nature and observe the world of plants, thinking of it as embedded in the element of water, we can understand our soul nature, we might call it the astral world, when we immerse ourselves in this living weaving, which belongs to the consciousness we have between sleeping and waking, as reflected in the outer shaping and forming of the animal world. We have to think of our own forming processes in the world of ideas as woven into the rhythms of the airy element. Much of what I have indicated to you about our human nature can be conceptualized quite concretely. To take such a concrete example, you breathe in, and the air goes into you through the lungs in the normal way. But once you have drawn this breath, the air enters the space occupied by the bone marrow and its surrounding fluid. Within the arachnoidal cavity, the fluid that surrounds the bone marrow is thrown rhythmically against the brain. The cerebral fluid comes into motion. The activity generated in the cerebral fluid is the activity of thinking. In reality, thought comes in waves on the in-breath, which are conveyed to the cerebral fluid, and the cerebral fluid, which keeps the brain afloat, conveys its rhythmic pulse to the brain itself. Our sense impressions from our eyes, ears, and other nerve sense activity live in the brain. The rhythm of our breathing collides with these sense impressions, and an interplay develops between our sense impressions and the activity of thought. This is the formal thought activity which is outwardly expressed in the forms of the animal world. It is brought about by the breathing rhythm as it encounters our cerebral fluid in the arachnoidal cavity, and then plays on the sense impressions living within our brain. This now contains all that rhythm has brought to life in us out of the world of ideas. The important thing is that you try gradually to penetrate the way the spirit plays into the physical world of the senses. The great damage done to culture in our time lies in the fact that we have a science that only reaches the spirit in abstract forms, in purely intellectualized forms, whereas the spirit has to be grasped in its creative element, failing which the material world remains outside it like something hard and untamed. We must gain an insight into how the third and fourth sets of principles we mentioned play a practical role in all that we do. It is the most wonderful thing when we become aware of and learn to know the true inner reason for what can take place within us with every breath we draw, can take place rather than does take place when the in-breath has its effect on our cerebral fluid. Now comes the reverse. The cerebral fluid is pressed back again through the arachnoidal cavity, and the out-breath follows. This is an act of devotion to the world, emerging into the world. The essence of what comes to expression in the rhythm of breathing is just this, becoming an I, capital, merging with the world, becoming an I, merging with the world. This is what we are referring to when we speak of the reality of the element of air, whereas the element of earth can only deal with what is contained in our 70-odd chemical elements. There you see it. What eventually turns into a corpse is subject to the set of principles governing the 72 elements. On the other hand, what brings activity into this collection of elements comes streaming in from the cosmos so that it can grow and digest. It is an element from beyond space that enables it not only to grow, to digest, but to manifest itself in continual rhythmic activity in the rhythm of our pulse and the rhythm of pulse and breath. We study this extra-spatial world in the element of air, for that is where it manifests itself. just as we study the cosmic world, not the earthly, in the element of water. That is where it is revealed. What is revealed to today's chemist or physicist is only based on the differentiated aspects of the element of earth. We can also find the crossing point into the element of warmth or fire, but that is only possible in practice when one has developed the faculty not only of consciously leaving one's body, but also merging this consciousness with other beings. There is a clear difference. It is perfectly possible to have the faculty of leaving one's body, even with a remnant of egotism in regard to the world, so that one can grasp all that I have spoken of so far. But one cannot really merge with this outer world. One cannot surrender to it. Once the elements of a capacity for genuine supersensible love are acquired, an immersion in the world in which we live between sleeping and waking, only then do we acquire a practical knowledge of the element of warmth or fire. Only then do we really know our own true nature. What we see with our senses from the outside is initially only an illusory image of the person from the other side, the sense perceptible side. If we raise our consciousness to the level of the element of water, it is at first the etheric being of the person that flows out before us. It becomes a miniature image of winter, summer, autumn, and so on. Once we reach the element of air, we become aware of a rhythmical movement. Our essential humanity, eternal in nature, can only be known through the element of warmth. This is where everything comes together, the moving and weaving of the water element and the rhythms and pulses of the element of air. They bring each other into balance, move in and out of harmony with each other in the element of warmth or fire. And that is where our own true essence can be known. Only then are we in the active principle of the cosmic spirit. When we are told today of how earlier science viewed earth, water, air, and fire, we should not think our modern-day science has made great advances. We should rather think there was once a totally different understanding of the human being as rooted in supersensible depths. At that time, they also knew about the different ways in which the element of earth related to the supersensible sphere. The element of water is already a little closer to it. The watery element is actually closer to the world of the spheres, spread out in the widths of the cosmos, than to the earth itself. However, when we seek the source of the rhythms of the air within us, in other words, our air organization, we leave the world of space completely. This is where we create rhythms and dissolve rhythms. Finally, we come to the universality beyond space, which even overcomes time, when we enter the element of fire, of warmth. Only then do we encounter the wholeness of our own nature. It may actually be found, albeit in a corrupted form, in literature, going back before the 15th century, once it has been rediscovered. And it is indeed necessary that it is rediscovered today. A couple of years ago, a piece of research was published by a Swedish academic on the topic of alchemy. This Swedish academic reads a process as described by an alchemist and says, quote, "If you examine this process today, it turns out to be pure nonsense. You can make nothing of it." Close quote. It is quite easy to understand how a modern chemist, even the Swede, who is somewhat less prejudiced than the Middle European ones, could take what is expressed in the form in which it appears in the corrupted literature of times gone by, replicate it, and then say that one can make nothing of it. I looked up the procedure in the literature that the good Swede could make nothing of, and found that the process described is actually related to a part of embryonic development, human embryonic development. That became evident very quickly. One just had to be able to read what was written. The modern chemist reads something like this and applies the terminology he has learned in his studies of chemistry. Then he sets up his retorts and replicates the process. Nonsense. What he had been reading was in fact part of a process that takes place in the development of the embryo in the mother's womb. You see, that illustrates the chasm that has opened up between what the modern academic can read and what was understood in earlier times. What was described then was based on concepts such as those we are rediscovering in more recent spiritual science. There is no way of reading these ancient writings until these concepts are rediscovered. They were accessible then, but by very different methods to those we are familiar with today. They were instinctive or atavistic, it is true, but they were accessible. And humanity has regressed from them to an understanding which is confined to the element of earth. It is now up to us to develop an understanding of the elements that goes beyond the mere corpse, toward a full understanding of the whole living human being. That will, however, require of our modern civilization that we open our minds in all seriousness to the question of pre-existence. When the concept of pre-existence was rejected in the course of Western cultural development, selfless research went with it. Today's sermons of whatever faith essentially appeal to human egotism. We know that people are afraid or uncomfortable about the thought of life ending. Of course, it doesn't end. But these sermons don't appeal to our powers of understanding. They appeal to our fear of death, to the desire to continue living on after the death of our body. In other words, they appeal to our egotism. This can't happen if we take pre-existence into account. As far as this egotism is concerned, it is actually a matter of complete indifference to people of our time whether or not they were alive before birth or before conception. They are alive now. They know that. That is why they are not particularly concerned with the question of pre-existence. It is the post-existence they are concerned about. They may be alive now, but don't know whether they will live on after death. This is all based on egotism. Given that they are alive now, and unless they have worked on their self-knowledge, they will say instinctively or unconsciously, quote, well, I am alive now, and whether or not I was alive before my birth or conception doesn't matter. The main thing is that I have now started to live and don't stop again, close quote. This is essentially the mood out of which people's feelings today can be enthused for immortality. In most familiar languages, there is therefore the word immortality to denote eternity after the end of life. But most major languages do not have a word for unbornness. This is something we must struggle to acquire over time. It would be better suited to a path of knowledge, a non-egotistic search for the source of our being. That is what is needed in our time. Knowledge in general must increasingly be infused with morality, with an ethical awareness. The development of our culture can only take an upward course once the laboratory table has become an altar, once synthesis and analysis have become a kind of spiritual art form, and when there is an awareness that any given action has an impact on the world's development. We shall inevitably fall into a terrible decline unless there is a more widespread understanding that our striving for knowledge must be free of egotism, that our knowledge must be fully imbued with morality, and must overcome the scientific methods of our time, which cannot deal with the higher worlds. We have to reach a new understanding of the rhythm that so profoundly affects our lives, and also of what is at work in our interactions with warmth. It is morality that works into us through warmth. Whilst there are simple variations in warmth, nuances of warmth, In reality, they consist of all permeating waves of morality within which we can develop our humanity. We must gradually become more aware of this. It is not simply an idealistic whim that challenges us to read the signs of our time, but rather the signs of our time themselves, which urge us toward a deepening of our understanding of the supersensible world. The end of Lecture 4.